Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Dawn Ireland from Cherubs. So tell me a little bit about Cherubs.
Cherubs is the Family Support Division of CDH International. It is a nonprofit that was started 24 years ago, next week actually, on my kitchen table with another mom and a typewriter after we met when our sons were both diagnosed with congenital diaphragmatic hernia at the same hospital in North Carolina in 1993. And Cherubs was created so that families weren't alone. In 93, there was no internet. There was no information. There were no support groups. There was no way for us to find other help or information that was in layman's terms and not straight from medical journals. So we created the organization so that families weren't alone, so they had some source of information. And just grew very quickly. And now Cherubs helps over 6,300 families in 70 countries, including Canada.
So how does the condition you mentioned typically affect a person?
Congenital diaphragmatic hernia, or CDH for short, is a birth defect that happens around 8 weeks in gestation. And it occurs when a baby's diaphragm doesn't fully form. The diaphragm is a muscle that moves when you get hiccups. It's also the muscle that helps you inhale, and it separates all the organs from your abdominal cavity and your chest cavity. Well, in these children, the diaphragms don't fully form, so the organs are able to migrate from the abdominal cavity into the chest cavity. So things like the stomach, the intestines, the spleen, liver can move up, and that doesn't allow room for lungs to develop. So it's very severe. And every child is different. Sometimes the hole in the diaphragm is very small. Sometimes it's very large. The amount of organ that moves up varies from child to child. And then the amount of lung that developed varies from child to child. But it is very severe. And these children require stabilization and surgery shortly after birth. 50% of the children do not survive. And that's in first world countries. And in most of the world, the survival rate is about 1%. So it's probably genetic, but we don't know that for certain yet. We narrowed it down to 100 genes, but we have some research to go. So as of right now, families don't know why it happens. And it happens equally to boys and girls, to every race, religion, socioeconomic status. It just plays no favorites, and it's been quite a struggle to find the cause of CDH and to raise awareness for it, because with this birth defect, the children who survive look normal on the outside. It could be you or me that see one of these kids or an adult. We have several adults now walking down the street, and you wouldn't know that they had such a rough start at the beginning unless you saw the scars from surgery. And that is an absolute blessing for the survivors. But it's a little hard for awareness, so most people don't know that these children exist. And for the the families who lose their children, infant death is not something that's commonly talked about in society. So awareness is very hard. And that's a very long answer to your question. I'm sorry. I tend to go on and on, so stop me mid-sentence if needed.
It's all right. So, in your time with CHERUBS, has there been any success in which you were able to provide support that stands out for you?
Yes, we've watched things change quite a bit in the last 24 years. When we first started out in the 90s, there were new procedures that came along, such as ECMO, which stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is a heart and lung bypass machine. That came out in the late 80s, early 90s for these kids. It was invented for adults, but it became available for pediatrics around that time. So the survival rate started to increase. And also, fetal surgery came along in the early 90s, where babies were being operated on while the mother was still pregnant. And that has evolved into laparoscopic surgery and plugging the baby's trachea to force the lungs to grow so it's not as evasive as actual surgical repair while the child is inside the mom. So the complications have decreased on that, though it is still only done on the absolute worst-case scenarios, most severe cases. So we watched that happen. We still struggle with things such as there's no international standard measurement of survival or mortality, or mortality and morbidity or standard of care. There is a standard of care specific to Canada that just came out 2 years ago. We're very proud of the Canadian surgeons for working together to create that. There's also a standard in other countries such as England and France. The United States does not have one yet. There's not an overall one internationally. So there are countries where the children have such little medical care opportunities available that the surgeons have only ever seen one or two cases in their entire careers. And when they get these cases, they don't know what to do because they don't have a standard of care. And so one of the things that we are doing is we're trying to set standard measurements of survival. And that means that right now, hospitals can give a survival rate based on whatever criteria they feel works best in their favor. And that's a little blunt, but it's very honest. So every hospital is measuring differently. So we don't have a true measurement of survival. We don't know what really works for these kids. So until we nail that down, research is much harder. So something that we're in the middle of doing right now is we're working with the World Health Organization to set an international one. So we're in the middle of that at the moment, and we're very proud to be able to lead that effort because the goal is to save these children's lives, and we really believe that's going to increase the survival rate, knowing exactly what we're working with these kids so that we can work together to increase those survival rates globally. So we're very proud of that.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
All right.
In this next segment of our show, we'll hear from Samara Manir from SMILE. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with SMILE.
I have been with SMILE for about 8 or 9 years right now. And I've volunteered. I started with them with just volunteering for their kids events. And I just kind of got reeled in. I've been doing kids events, outreach, a little bit of, working with the families and organizing their fundraisers and the galas. And I love every minute of it. Like, it's a good feeling.
So for those who might not be as familiar with SMILE's work, can you take me through it a little bit?
SMILE, what we do is we support families who have children with varying disabilities, and so it really is case-to-case basis. They come in, they have the questions and concerns, and we try to do our best to be a support, if it's that funding or it's something as simple as, hey, I would like my child to make more friends, and or like, you know, interact with other kids, and we're like, great, bring them to our kids' events. It's a great opportunity to meet other parents and their families who might be going through a similar situation, or just so the kids have someone else that they can interact with. You know what I mean? A bit of a safe space. So it's just, we have youth events. So we do a little bit of everything. We have kids' events, youth events, our fundraisers. We have therapy programs, and then obviously scholarships. So we try to offer as much as we can.
So are there any challenges in the work itself?
Of course. There's always going to be challenges. Realistically, the system itself has its red tape, like many know. Funding can be moved around, like it recently did with the Ford government. So that is something that can change a lot of things, and parents obviously can get overwhelmed with that. And what we have to do is just do our best to make sure that we support them as much as we can, and that's really what we try to do. We just try to be as positive and as we can, and just find a solution. And but there's always going to be a headache. There's always going to be a challenge. That's just a part of it.
So when you mentioned finding the solutions, mm-hmm. your time with Smile, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
So with working with children, and, you don't see the changes overnight, You'll see the changes, how therapy is helping them, how coming to the kids' events are helping them. You won't see it overnight. You'll see it after a few months, after a few years, and the child that came to you initially is now just a completely new person a few years later. And those success stories are usually after a while. Like, you don't see them, overnight. Like, it's not like when you bake a cake and you just see the cake right after 30 minutes. So the success stories are just seeing the kids kind of grow just become more of who they are. And you can just seeing how therapy is helping them. I like seeing that as well, their progress.
So if you could send any one message to the community about why Smile's work matters, what would you say?
Smile's work matters because these kids, and the kids that we have in our circle, need the support. And there's so many kids that we haven't reached out to that need that support, that need to know that the community cares, that, they just need the support. And it is a need. So Smile's work is really important. And if they could just come to one event, and they would pretty much fall in love with Smile. And if you can get yourself out to come to one event and just see what these kids are about, see what these families are about, see their strengths, then I think, like, many of us who volunteer with Smile automatically fall in love with the cause. We're like, okay, we want to do more. We want to reach more families. We want to help more people. We want to do better and, allow, everyone to have an equal life and a fair life. And that's what we're here about. So, that's what I think everyone should support Smile for.
So what was it that led you to want to be involved with Smile in the first place?
Initially, I was like, so a friend of mine actually introduced me to Smile and saying that she knew Sakina, one of the founder, and she had a great organization. I was like, you know what? I do love kids, and I would love to volunteer. So when I went to my first kids event, I just fell in love with the whole thing. I felt like it was such a great need for, the community. And then, I can't really explain it. I just fell in love with it, and I couldn't let go. And so I've been around since. It was just a really surreal moment for me. I just fell in love with the children, and I can never, even if some days I might be tired, but I'm like, the kids need me. So, so it's just a part of it. I just love it.
Well, that's the thing, though. Working with kids, it'll energize you and invigorate you every time. See
it
them.
Really does. And they love you unconditionally, So these kids, their faces you know, light up. You know, they recognize, some of them don't recognize you because you see them once or twice a year, but you're still, you've been watching them grow up, and so they're a part of you, you know, and I love to see who they're becoming, and, you know, seeing their growth and their, you know, and their success, and I just love every moment of it.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yep.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
There are so many ways to listen to CJAM FM. You can hear us at 99.1 FM on your radio dial, stream us online anytime at www.cjam.ca, or download archives from the website to take with you on your preferred listening device. You can tune in on Cogeco Cable 285, or download the UWindsor app and click on the CJAM button. But no matter how you tune in CJAM 99.1 FM, we're reaching higher ground in Windsor, Detroit, and beyond.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Dawn Ireland from Cherubs and from Samara Manier from Smile. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Bonnie Brayton from the Disabled Women's Network. So tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with Dawn.
Hi, Cam. Thanks very much for having me on the show today, and appreciate the follow-up in terms of what Dawn's been up to. I think we, like a lot of other national disability organizations, have spent a lot of the last year, you know, following with great interest the proceedings towards the the passing of Bill C-81. I think that's a big one that's on our minds and on the minds of probably a lot of Canadians. And I think through that process, what I would say was, you know, really important to me, and certainly to, I think, a lot of the leaders in the disability community, was seeing that the ability to connect with Canadians with disabilities is there, and that if the resources are put in place, that we can do something that really does create the space to allow Canadians with disabilities to be more included in society and in decisions that affect them. So, you know, I think that's, at a high level, one of the things I'm taking away from Bill C-81, and going forward, of course, because big news, of course, we had in December, Cam, was that the federal government has managed to work out the optional protocol, and that the provinces and territories of our country signed on to the optional protocol. So, you know, I feel like we're at a convergent moment. I don't know about you, Cam, but like I said, I have this sense that we're at a convergent moment for our people in this country. There's just so many different things going on, including, you know, new statistics.
So, can you take me through some of the statistics that have come out of all this?
Well, I think the one that's, you know, obviously for Dawn, very significant, and I think very significant, and one that, you know, since I've had the statistic and begun to share it, can see the impact it has on people's understanding of something that I think, you know, they thought was really not their concern, which is that 24% of all women in Canada live with a disability. That's according to Statistics Canada. So fully one quarter of all women in this country have, in Statistics Canada speak, identified themselves as women with disabilities. Given that we know that there's always some people who do not report because of stigma, because of different reasons, in some cases not recognizing what they have as a disability, that they don't report. So right there, just that alone tells us that we have some hugely important information that needs to have an impact, not just, of course, on the people it's about, that's women with disabilities, but on everybody in terms of the meaning of that in a Canadian context, in terms of who we are. So, and, you know, one quarter of all women means that's, like I said, a significant marker in terms of policy shifts that need to occur. It's 20% for men, and again, in some provinces and territories it's higher and in some it's lower, but the mean, the average across the country, is 24% for women and 20% for men. And again, Cam, you know, that brings me back to this idea that it's about critical mass, because that means we have a lot of power, you know, and it brings me back to what I was saying before, which is that it's time for us as a community to organize ourselves in a way that we can not just have input on something like Bill C-81, which of course is a significant thing because it's federal accessibility legislation, but policies across all issues. And, you know, a really vigorous engagement in terms of this election, because when this election, federal election, comes up, we need to make sure that disability and the fact that the Accessibility Act hopefully gets passed by this government, that going forward, whether the next government is a Liberal or Conservative government, that we have a government that's going to honor the commitments made under the Accessibility Act, honor the commitments made through the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, and including now, of course, the significant shift in terms of the finding of the optional protocol. So, because I don't know how many of your viewers understand that, but the reason the optional protocol is so important is because, of course, it gives, again, to citizens with disabilities an important right in terms of their ability to make complaints and to point out when their provincial government is not honoring its commitments as well under the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, because, as we know, provinces and territories hold the purse when it comes to many of the programs that either could positively but too often negatively affect our community.
So what policy shift would you most want to see actually take place, the potential being there?
Well, I think it's not a policy shift per se, as a shift in the way that policy is done, interpreted, and then implemented is where I would go with this, Cam. You know, Dawn Canada, and I think you and I have talked about this on your show before, we did a research project over 3 years that looked at legislation, policy, and service responses to violence against women with disabilities in Canada. And out of that research, of course, what we found was that the big problem was the gap in policy, the ungendering of women with disabilities in violence prevention policy, the footnoting of women with disabilities in violence prevention policy. And I can tell you that that phenomena is something that we know is happening to women with disabilities across all of their needs in terms of, you know, services and support. But it's not just, you know, limited to women with disabilities. It's in general. I think, you know, one of the things that certainly disability activists, you know, have been able to see more clearly over the last few years is one of the other challenges we have, which is with, and I would say it's a challenge and an opportunity to think of how important it is for us to work with other advocates, other social justice movements. Because I think the thing that I would say, you know, is clear for Dawn, Cam, is that the gap in policy is linked to an absence of policymakers to think about how you address policy from an intersectional perspective. So they want to look at a policy that affects women or disability or being Indigenous, but, you know, it's a lot more challenging to try and think of how you take a policy that takes into account those three different intersecting identities. And, you know, like I said, that's because so much of what is done in society for us by the bureaucratic infrastructures we have at government levels are siloed into departments and into areas. And, of course, people don't really line up very well with that kind of an approach, because we aren't departments and we aren't areas. We're people. And, you know, a woman with a disability who lives in Montreal has a very different experience than a woman with a disability who lives in Iqaluit. That's, you know, an obvious thing to think about, but it's not something that's been easy. And I'm not saying that it's not without its challenges. But that shift is critical, because what we've been able to see is that the most marginalized people in every community we think of, Indigenous people, racialized people, immigrant people, people with disabilities, and indeed women in many respects, depending on, you know, what that other intersection is that we haven't been very effective. We haven't moved the poverty needle. We haven't moved the homelessness needle. We haven't moved the violence prevention needle. You know, a lot of these social issues that have been affecting specific groups negatively for a long time just aren't getting better. And part of the reason is, like I said, the absence of understanding that, you know, complex issues require a much more nuanced approach, and one that includes the people who are affected by it.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Disability, my friends, is the great crossroads. As Bonnie alluded to in her interview, a person is more than just any one thing. They aren't just a woman or just of a certain cultural background or just a person with a disability. It's the many facets put all together that make a person who and what they are. And the fact is, policymakers, world leaders, we all need to factor that in. I mean, if you're meeting someone for the first time, do you look at them and say, this is just a person with a disability, that's all they are? Or do you say, that's one part of what makes them special, one factor that contributes to their identity? And do you take the time to sit down, have that conversation with them, find out what their story is? Maybe they were someone who wasn't born with a disability. Maybe it was acquired in an accident. Maybe they're an athlete who had to rediscover the game after their injury. Maybe they had to find a new way to continue what they love. Maybe they had to learn that strength. But the point is, you're never going to know unless you ask the question. And we as a people need never limit ourselves in who we want to get to know. Reach out. A person is more than just any one thing. Everyone has a great story to share. If you're someone with a disability story, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, the numeral 4, gmail.com. Always love to hear from you folks at home. As for the work being done with anyone with a disability, as was alluded to during Sammer's interview, you should start when a person's young, when their minds are open to the ideas, the possibilities of what life can be. For I guarantee, especially with young kids, if they're around someone with a disability at a young age, they're going to grow up, they're just going to look, and they're going to say, this is a person. This is not some burden or obligation that society has, and we don't have to go out of our way to include them. Inclusion is not an afterthought, my friends. It is simply the result of wanting to be in a person's life, wanting to share in their story. And when you're molding the mind of a young kid, as she did through Smile, they're going to grow up, and they're going to understand that in order to have a complete picture, one must be willing to look at a complete picture. One must be willing to say, okay, so there's a disability here, but is that the entire foundation? Is that what's holding the pyramid up? No. Hopes, dreams, goals, aspirations, experiences, all of that plays a role, not to mention support systems. The worst thing anyone with a disability or without can do is try to take on the world's problems all on their own. Make the problems bigger than they are. Say, I'm the martyr for this. I have to suffer. No one else can understand. No one else can help me. Sounds good if you're into lying to yourself. For the fact is, there's always someone willing to share an insight or an opportunity. If you don't find an answer immediately, that doesn't mean the answer doesn't exist. It just means the search has to continue a while longer. It just means that you have to keep asking the questions, pushing for equal rights, pushing for opportunities, but showing a genuine respect that people aren't more entitled to this opportunity or that based on any one factor. Equality is built on the idea that we all have potential to achieve. We all have that moment that defines who we are and what we're supposed to become. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.